capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to Level Talk Programme. My name's John Harrison. Sanctions seem to be used by powerful states as an instrument of foreign policy more and more often these days. In the mid-20th century, only five countries were sanctioned, but this number increased to almost 50 by 2000. An increasing number of foreign policy experts, however, are asking if sanctions do actually work. The sanctions against Russia, for example, have to date not forced Russia to change either her external or internal policies. Many international observers have noticed that the sanctions against North Korea seem to be doing the same thing. That is, not very much. Moreover, they're in fact driving North Korea to an unashamedly military footing and strengthening that country's resolve. Now, it might well be time we question the whole value of sanctions. And joining me on this program to hopefully do exactly that is Dr. Lee Jones, Reader International Politics at Queen Mary University of London, and Professor Daniel Kovalik, Lecturer of International Human Rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome, both you gentlemen, to the program.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
It's an introduction to your book, Dr. Lee. The general logic underpinning sanctions is that economic pain will somehow produce political gain. But as you quite rightly point out, we have seen very little of this. And I'm just wondering, as to start off this programme, do sanctions work in your opinion? I know this is a subject you've written a book about, so I'm not going to ask you to expound in great detail. But in a few words, do sanctions actually work? Or not?
The general consensus is that they work about one third of the time, so they have a two thirds failure rate.
Right. Well, that's a very concise answer. Thank you very much. Why doesn't the general public know about this? Or are we actually told before sanctions are applied that they might not work?
Well, I think you have to think about it relative to other policy options. So quite often they're seen as something that's between war and words. So it's not just wagging your finger and saying we disapprove of a foreign government.
Yeah.
And it's not as drastic as going to war. So it's somewhere in the middle. At least it gives you a feeling that you're doing something substantial. So that's why they tend to get used, even when they've got quite a high failure rate, that they're better than the alternatives, it seems. But in many cases, they actually prepare countries for war.
Yeah.
And there's also a lot of contestation around that one-third success rate. So some people say the success rate is as low as 5%.
In what kind of cases do sanctions work, and in what kind of instances do they not work?
It's very difficult to draw patterns. So there's a lot of research suggesting that authoritarian regimes are quite resilient in the face of sanctions because they're insulated from the social and political pressures that sanctions might unleash in their societies. A lot of that work's quite crude,
yeah.
But you know, you can think that would broadly hold. And of course, it is mostly authoritarian regimes that get targeted by sanctions. So there's a kind of selection bias here that the countries that are bound to be the most resilient to sanctions tend to be the ones that are hit with them the most, which may account for the very high failure rate.
Yeah, and of course, now we're living in a new kind of world, aren't we? We're living in a multipolar world rather than a unipolar world. It's changed. Everything's changed since the end of the Second World War. America is no longer the world's only power, which means that if we sanctioned a country in the past, then that country would probably suffer because you couldn't get whatever it was sanctioned for or against by other countries, but now other countries can supply those things. So I guess the whole point of sanctions could be debated, couldn't it?
Well, I think, yeah, globalization and economic diffusion has certainly made enforcing sanctions a lot harder. But even so, I mean, you take a country like North Korea, for example, that you've mentioned, 90% of North Korea's trade is with China. So if China chose to enforce the sanctions, it could have a crippling economic effect on North Korea. Would it have the desired political outcome, though? I mean, that's what my book, Societies Under Siege, is questioning, is economic pain doesn't always translate into the political gain that you seek.
Mm-hmm.
And that is precisely why China does not impose sanctions or does not enforce sanctions fully on North Korea, because it believes it would have politically disastrous consequences like the collapse of the regime and the influx of large numbers of refugees.
Right. Professor Kovalik, could I ask you, as somebody who's interested in the humanitarian side of things, Do the people who write these sanctions, are they thinking about the people, the populations, or are they thinking more about possible regime change influencing the political landscape at the expense of the populations concerned?
Yes, well, I think the latter explanation is correct. I mean, I would even go a little further than that. I think most of the sanctions regimes aren't even intended to affect the country that's being sanctioned. It's more for internal domestic consumption. So, for example, the U.S. Congress just passed these new sanctions against Russia right after Trump met with Putin, and they agreed to cooperate in numerous spheres. I mean, what spheres of influence in Syria and Ukraine? I mean, what, the sanctions didn't seem necessary at all to deal with Russia. Russia was happy to deal with this. In fact, they seem to be passed again for political gain in the U.S. Similarly with Iran. You know, we just sanctioned Iran after Trump begrudgingly admitted that Iran is actually holding up its part of the nuclear deal. And meanwhile, they've never gotten the benefit of the nuclear deal because the first round of sanctions were never lifted. I was just in Iran about a month ago, and their economy has been hurt by about 20% from the sanctions that should have been lifted to begin with when they were complying and continue to comply with the nuclear deal. So one, sanctions many times aren't even calculated to deal with the things they're claimed to deal with. And two, as you say, the countries, and the U.S. is the biggest offender here, tend not to care about the suffering of your average everyday person in passing those sanctions. I mean, another example is the U.S.'s unilateral embargo against Cuba, which has cost that economy billions and billions of dollars, you know, caused suffering to the Cuban people, and yet the U.S. claims it's doing it to the benefit of the Cuban people, when in fact it's hurting it. So, and by the way, my feeling is, and others agree with me, including the German, Germany just recently said this regarding the Russia sanctions, that if a country like the U.S. wants to sanction another country, they need to go through the Security Council. They can't just sanction another country. The Security Council is in charge of maintaining international peace and security. And if the U.S. thinks there's a threat to that, they should go to the Security Council. Instead, as you note, the U.S. in particular has decided to sanction everyone and their mother at this point at will. And that's not how the international system is supposed to work.
Okay, I'm fascinated by, actually, both of you gentlemen have made the same comment, that there seems to be for internal consumption. Are you saying, in other words, that if we sanction, the nasty North Koreans, it'll be okay because we're doing something about it? Is that what you're saying in a nutshell? Either of you, sir.
Yeah, no, I don't agree with that at all. In particular, when you look at North Korea, I think when we sanction them more and more, it tends to paint them into a corner.
Yeah.
And then they decide that the only thing they can do to get out of that corner is to be as bellicose as possible, to conduct these missile tests and whatnot. I think they're actually counterproductive. And again, I think, though, they are done to at least, you know, claim to the American people we're doing something, when again, they probably have the unintended consequence of creating more of a possibility of war. So I think I tend to be against these sanctions regimes for that reason.
Okay, is this something to do with the idea of a new world order, a great huge world order sitting in space somewhere, ruled by liberalism or something like that, that would determine what is right and what is wrong? Because if a country sanctions another country, that means that country thinks it knows best. It knows best. But we're living in, as I said before, a multipolar world, aren't we? And it's very difficult now, I think, to say that one country or one system, even one group of countries knows best. And it's perhaps not like that when you're sitting in the States or in London, but it definitely feels like that if you're sitting in Moscow. You know, doubts are coming into people's minds. My question is, how long is this going to carry on for? Because they're not working. These sanctions are not working in Russia. They seem to be doing the opposite. In fact, Russia seems to be getting itself more together. It's having to improvise and create, the goods which it used to import itself, and so on and so on and so on. How long is this, this belief in the sanctions going to carry on for?
Well, I think for the reasons that Daniel's outlined, they will tend to last. because they do serve a variety of purposes. They're not always about the ostensible target or the ostensible reasons behind the sanctions regime. They can be for domestic political purposes, like Daniel says. And also they can be aimed at the international system. Sanctions started to be used heavily in the late 1980s, early 1990s, with the rise of what then President Bush said was the New World Order, as you mentioned, an attempt to sort of say, well, there are certain rules and certain practices that we think should be followed, and we'll punish everybody that doesn't. We tend to see the European Union, for example, tends to impose a lot of sanctions around human rights and democracy promotion, and the United States also does that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of functions that are served by sanctions, internal ones, external ones, and ones related to the target. And I think, go back to my earlier point, you know, what's the alternative? If there's a belief on the part of policymakers that they've got to do something about some so-called rogue state or something, and they're not prepared to take military action, and wagging one's finger and complaining diplomatically is not enough, then sanctions always has this temptation. It's sitting there. It seems to be this tough weapon that they can reach for and say, oh, look, we're doing something about this, which is not necessarily meaningful, may in fact be very counterproductive, but it's not just wagging your finger or going all out to war. So I think for those reasons, it will continue despite the ongoing power shift in the global political economy.
Yeah. Could it be counterproductive? I mean, could this sort of movement from, you know, human security to R2P and then the imposition of sanctions actually get to the point where it's destroying the credibility of the very countries which are imposing the sanctions? I mean, what's happening in Europe now, the secondary sanctions, you know, on European countries. Now we've got a situation where the German government is saying, suggesting that the new sanctions are a US business plot to promote LNG exports to Europe, you know. I mean, again, I have my doubts whether the US, I'm sorry to talk about the US all the time, but yeah, the US can get away with this sort of line. You say can, Dr. Lee. Professor Carvalho, what do you think?
Well, I'd like to certainly believe it cannot. I am very critical of US foreign policy. You mentioned R2P. I believe R2P, you know, the right to protect, the responsibility to protect, is the contrary to international law. I think even if it weren't, I think the U.S.'s position that somehow it has the moral right to impose such a thing is an absurdity. I don't see any case where the U.S. has engaged in any humanitarian intervention that has actually done anything to improve humanity. I think the 82nd Airborne is not a human rights organization, and people who believe it are foolish. I think that the American people, it's why I wrote the book I did, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, need to wake up to the fact that it's their country that is more of a threat to the rest of the world than any other country. And in fact, polls of the people around the world show that, in fact, that is the belief of the rest of the world. And of course, it's grounded in fact. You know, the U.S. says, oh, look at Putin in Ukraine. Look at Putin in Syria. Meanwhile, the U.S. is in the Ukraine. The U.S. is in Syria, plus Libya, plus Iraq, plus Afghanistan. It is the U.S. that is this global empire. I think all these sanctions and all these threats that the U.S. is using right now is really the sound of an empire in grave distress. And I think it's time for the American empire to end, just as the British, you know, at some point decided it wasn't worth having their empire. I think the U.S. needs to first be honest and say we are an empire and then decide.
Yeah, but we still believe we've got one, we British. You know, we're still very good at thinking we've still got an empire. Hence Brexit. Okay, let's take a short break here.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Program. Today I'm joined by Dr. Lee Jones, a reader in international politics at Queen Mary University of London, and Professor Daniel Kovalik, lecturer of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And we're discussing the effectiveness of sanctions, in particular in regards to Russia and North Korea. Now, gentlemen, are sanctions actually legal? And are they ethical? I mean, one version I've heard is that when you apply sanctions against another country and the population is going to suffer, I mean, in a way, you're committing an act of terrorism because population can't do anything about it, can it? The population isn't able to protest and change the course of its government. But the population may suffer.
Well, let me address the ethical point, because Daniel's the lawyer, not me. On the ethics side, I mean, this was a major area of controversy in the 90s because of the imposition of sanctions on Iraq and the deaths of large numbers of Iraqi civilians. And that was what was behind a major change in sanctions practices, particularly at the United Nations, but also in Europe, towards more targeted or smart sanctions, which supposedly avoid collateral damage on the wider population. So that's how sanctions were rescued from previous criticisms. And that's one of the reasons why I think whether we might like it or not, sanctions are likely to continue because they have a way to warp around these criticisms.
Right, because now they're sort of more focused on particular individuals or particular branches.
Yeah, but the reality is that collateral damage does still continue, even in targeted sanctions cases, because elites are very good at displacing the effects of sanctions onto ordinary people, and also because of the use of sectoral sanctions. So sanctions that target parts of the economy, such as the oil sector or the banking sector, which then have major knock-on effects on the wider economy. And you cannot really target in any meaningful way a foreign country without having an impact on the wider population.
No.
And the question then becomes, why are you doing it? And if you're doing it for reasons that are about your own internal politics or to uphold global imperial structures or whatever, then it's profoundly unethical. You know, it violates a really basic ethical principle, which is Kant's categorical imperative, which is that you don't use individuals as an instrument to some other end. You don't try to harm them in order to achieve political goals.
Right, which is exactly what happens in many cases.
Yes, if I can add to that, I totally agree with what my colleague just said, and I think the Iraq example is a great one. You know, there's the famous line when Madeleine Albright was confronted with the fact that the sanctions against Iraq killed 500,000 children. She said it was worth it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it gives you a good mindset as to where the U.S. government, even the liberal ones, are on this sort of thing. But yes, to kill children with sanctions can be more lethal than, frankly, killing them with weapons, and we've seen that. Iraq was a classic example. Again, Cuba has suffered greatly under the U.S. sanctions that have now been going on for over 50 years. You know, it was pointed out the idea, and it's many times the idea of sanctioning a country, certainly the idea for Cuba and Venezuela, in order to, in the words of Kissinger, who was talking about Chile under Allende, to make the economy scream so that people push for regime change, I would say is both unethical and also clearly against international law. Again, the Security Council needs to, you know, be invoked to impose such sanctions. And moreover, humanitarian law forbids making civilians suffer for political ends. As you noted, that's actually the definition of terrorism. That's exactly what we tend to decry, and yet it's a tool that we often use against other countries.
What chances are there of that happening, of cases having to be taken to the Security Council before sanctions are introduced against another country? I mean, I see that Article 41 in the UN Charter provides for economic and other kinds of non-military measures for maintaining or restoring international peace or security. It doesn't mention the word sanctions, but that's what it's talking about. But it doesn't specify. Right. There's a lot of things it doesn't specify. For example, you know, it doesn't talk at all about humanitarian rights.
Well, the Charter does not, but then things that flow from the Charter do, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Of course, the Geneva Conventions, which the U.S. is a party to, which even predate the U.N. Charter, those things do require, you know, the protection of civilians when you're talking about sanctions or acts of war or whatever. And again, we tend to, in fact, do the opposite. We tend to target the civilians to put pressure on the governments, which is totally unlawful. Now, the chances of going through the Security Council for sanctions, I think, have become nil. I mean, again, the U.S. has decided it can act unilaterally, not just, you know, through sanctions, but even through war. The case of Yugoslavia, of course, Clinton went out of his way to try to make that point through the war on Yugoslavia, and we've done it since. And so, obviously, the international system is broken to a large extent, And there needs to be a way to reconstruct it.
Dr. Lee, is there a case here for linking liberalism with imposition of sanctions?
Well, certainly there's a link between the two. I mean, can I just add one thing about the Security Council, though, which is that the Security Council is a political body, and of course the main barrier to getting things done through the Security Council is the veto of the permanent five members. So we mustn't lose sight in this of the fact that the sanctions were imposed on Russia after Russia unilaterally invaded and annexed part of a foreign country. So, you know, the fault of intervention is not just purely on the U.S. side, although it's predominantly on the U.S. side, but some might say Russia deserves more than sanctions. But on the point about liberalism
yeah.
and sanctions are tied very intimately together. From the earliest ideas around sanctions, people like Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. president and former academic who was behind the League of Nations, he thought that sanctions would be a way of maintaining international order without needing war. And he's, liberal to his core. The idea is that everybody's got their price. People are fundamentally motivated by pecuniary economic incentives. So if you can manipulate their economic costs and benefits, that will change their political behavior. That's the basic idea behind sanctions. So if you make people poorer, they'll think, oh, well, let's just change what we're doing and then we'll get richer again. And of course, the reality is that people are motivated by a whole host of very complex incentives, and they will be willing to make economic sacrifices for political and ideological goals. And that's what's happening in Russia, for example. So all the opinion polls show that people saw that sanctions were damaging the economy. They blamed sanctions for the economic losses. They thought that their situation was getting worse. But at the same time, their support for the Putin government and its foreign policy has increased enormously, and their hostility towards the West have increased enormously. So it has the exact opposite effect to the one that liberals would anticipate.
Well, I was just going to say, I think Dr. Lee, brings up Woodrow Wilson. I think he's actually a great case in point. He was elected into office promising to keep us out of World War One. In fact, we entered the war within 6 months of him taking office, and in part because economic measures that were taken before World War One and again before World War Two, actually helped pave the way for war. I think sanctions, in my own view of history, have tended not to avert war, but have tended to be the precursor, the match that tends to light the fuel of war. And so, I'd like to throw out a crazy idea and maybe advocate that the countries, especially the U.S., which have given up diplomacy, that they actually may be trying to use diplomacy once in a while. Maybe we talk to each other, whatnot. And again, I'm very disturbed by the fact that, Trump was willing to sit...
What's that? Sorry, I've forgotten what diplomacy actually means.
we might have to check the Oxford Dictionary for that. But,
Yeah, right. I mean, I live in Moscow. I've nobody told me what diplomacy is all about.
Trump sat down with Putin and they seemed to have some diplomatic breakthrough, and then we imposed more sanctions. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got to finish the program in about 2 minutes. It's one of these situations I'd love to make some sort of conclusion or a point. I guess that's impossible, isn't it? But if we've established a link between liberalism and sanctions, would it be preposterous to suggest that somehow we need to move on from liberalism? I don't know what into, for heaven's sakes, or back to something else, I don't know. But the problem is the political system itself. It seems to sanctions, the creation of another, the creation of enemies, which seems to be necessary all the time for survival of our economic systems. Perhaps that's the problem. I'm opening this up to, I can be shot down. Go ahead.
Well, I would say that liberalism has all kinds of problems and has created all kinds of injustices in the world. But at the moment, there is no structural alternative to it. And this is one reason why I think this political system and the sanctions regimes that accompany it will continue. Because right now, opposition to liberalism is pretty weak. There is no real alternative. And the alternative is being pushed by countries like China and Russia, and not appealing to the vast majority of people. So even following the global financial crisis and all the problems associated with liberal societies, it will kind of trundle on until something better comes along to overthrow it, I think.
Professor Govalli, your opinion, please.
Well, I tend to agree with Dr. Lee that right now there's very little, you know, real movement to oppose liberalism, and the movements that tend to exist are not necessarily ones. The ones that seem to predominate, you know, seem to be coming from the hard right at this point, which is certainly alarming. I don't know if I can use this word on air, but, you know, I'm a socialist, so I would like to see more of a
socialist
from the left that can do that. I'll never be invited on again.
No, you'll be banned forever. You're on the blacklist now. Okay. Socialist, whoa! yeah.
But that movement seems weak at the moment, so... Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah, so it doesn't look too good, does it? I think all three of us agree that the sanction regime as a whole, as it is at the moment, even in its focused form, even its sort of Mark II version, is not really working. It needs to be improved. Foreign policy experts, instigators, writers, please do pay attention. It seems that we do have a problem here. Anyway, I'd like to thank you very much indeed, Dr. Lee Jones, reader in international politics at Queen Mary University of London, and Professor Daniel Kovalik, lecturer of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, for talking to us today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you very much indeed for being with us today. Please tune in again next week. Goodbye.